Thank you so much, Alex, and thank you to the Center for Cities, and thank you for all of you being here. It's kind of a thrill for me to be up here on the Shard, and I'll tell you why, because I was in this part of London around 1956, and there were a lot of shards here. There were shards of glass and shards of concrete still left over, because there were a lot of car parks in this part of London back then, bomb car parks. And to see what has happened in the 50 or 60 years since then is really quite remarkable, and a remarkable tribute to what's possible in cities when they're dynamically led and when they have a citizen population. And I'm talking about mayors today, but I want to say any discussion of cities starts etymologically with the key term citizen. Cité and citoyen, lord and burgher, city. Citizen have a common root. This is where citizenship starts, in the city. And our national leaders, whether it's in Washington or Whitehall or in Brussels, where they seem to think that sovereignty starts there and goes down to European citizens, which is one reason Europe is in trouble right now, seem to forget the reality that sovereignty and citizenship come bottom up, and they start and they are manifested in the polis, in the municipality, in the city, which are our first communities that define who we are. And the argument I want to make today, rather briefly, is that cities today, after 400 years being eclipsed by nation states, are once again likely to become the principal sites of governance, democracy, and globally relevant citizenship. So that's, I'm going to back up a little and tell a little historical story to make that argument. That's the argument I do want to make, and that I think you will see leads to some optimism in a deeply dark world right now. I've just come this morning from New York, where unfortunately I have to share my citizenship with someone named Donald Trump. He's, believe it or not, from New York. And I've said that if he's elected, probably I'll have to move back to Britain, where I've spent many happy years. All of my friends here say, yes, but if Brexit passes, we'll move in to New York. So I guess we all need together to look for a third place. But it's not so easy, is it? You know, maybe Austria, where the reactionary right-wing party came within a few votes electing a xenophobic right-wing party there. Maybe to Brazil, where the entire national government has more or less been dethroned as a basis of scandal. Maybe in Venezuela, where there is no effective government. Maybe to Belgium, where again, national government simply doesn't work. We live in a world, in other words, where governance is not working, where in many ways we can say nation states are in default. They simply don't govern well. We have a national crisis, an international crisis with national governments, and that is a crisis that also becomes a crisis for democracy, because for the last 400 years, nation states have been the conservators and the guardians of democracy. Democracy was born in the nation state, the great revolutions, the French Revolution, the American Revolutions, Italian revolutions. Those revolutions all took place in nation states. And in fact, for the last 400 years, the principal institutions of democracy and of governance have been nation states right around the globe. And that worked pretty well, because in fact, if you think about it, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th, and into the 20th century, the economy, health, education, jobs, security, environmentalism, toxins were all a function. Gosh, people are already leaving. We didn't see enough. We live in a world of interdependent global challenges, and yet we respond to them with 17th century bordered, independent, sovereign nation states that can hardly. And in that asymmetry, in that dichotomy, lies the principal problem of the 21st century. How do we respond to global interdependent problems with independent sovereign states born 300 or 400 years ago? How do we conserve democracy when it's associated with and wrapped up inside the nation state? That's the kind of problem we face. And by the way, I'm not an urbanist, I'm not a cities guy, I'm a political theorist. I've worked with nation states and international organizations most of my life because that's where governance was. But it's not where it is today. We start today in a world where national jurisdiction and national solutions to global problems simply don't function. When I was growing up in Manhattan, my mother used to say, "Don't go to Brooklyn, dear, there's a virus over there. I don't want you to get sick." I still live in Manhattan. I don't worry about the Brooklyn virus. I worry about Zika. I worry about HIV. I worry about Mexican pig flu, West Nile virus, the new diseases coming out of the hot zones of Africa. And we all worry about pandemic disease. My first car as a young man was a Chevrolet. As an American car, I was a patriot. Today, I drive a BMW. Not as a foreign car, but because my BMW was built in South Carolina from 70% American parts. It was American Chevrolets. American Chevrolets are built mostly in Mexico and other parts of the world from 80% foreign parts. What's an American car? What's a British car? What's a German car? It doesn't exist anymore. That notion that national economies, national jobs can be confined to nations simply doesn't make sense. There's no Lester warming, no Bristol warming, no Lyon warming, no New York warming. It's global warming. No Surrey net, no Manchester web. It's the world wide web. Global technology. And you say, well, yeah, sure. What's the point? The point is we live in a globalized, interdependent world, and yet we still have governments that were born of an age where most of these issues were within the jurisdictional authority and competence of our governments. And that simply doesn't work today. So the real point about Brexit is not that it's xenophobic, not that it's isolationist, not that it's anti-European, but that it's insane. Because we live in a world that not just where Britain is part of Europe, but Britain is part of the world. And the idea that somehow going to put up a wall. I mean, Donald Trump built a wall 2,000 miles across Mexico. Again, the problem with that is not that it's anti-Mexican. It's crazy. You can't wall off peoples. There are already 12 million undocumented Latinos in the United States. I guess the wall will keep them in, not out. A wall against terrorism? In San Bernardino, a born American did the job. In Orlando last week, a born American did the job. The interdependence of our world has already mixed things up in a way that suggests walls are simply pointless. And thinking that walls, whether they're walls of identity, British identity against European identity, or physical walls to stop people from moving across boundaries, simply don't make sense. That's the reality of our world. How then will we govern ourselves in this interdependent world where all the forces we're dealing with, whether they're economic or demographic or environmental, technological, how will we deal with such a world in which that is the reality and our governmental institutions are grounded in, organized around these antique notions of a sovereign, independent, monocultural society. England, the English, this fair island. Shakespeare did it beautifully. But there is no more England. Not at least in London, not in Leicester, not in Bristol. There's no France and Paris and Lyon and Marseille. There's no Mexico and Mexico City. Those are all multicultural cultures, with people from all over the world, and cities, in fact, have been multicultural all the way back. New York in 1785 had as many Germans and Scots and Irish as it had English, pure English. We were multicultural even back then. The country wasn't. Go to Jefferson, go to Virginia, it wasn't. But the cities were and are. The reality is our cities embody and represent the whole global world. Multicultural, diverse, based on trade. 90% of cities are on water or trade ways. In touch with others. In the 10th century, remember the Hansa cities on the North Sea that linked together cities in 9 or 10 different kingdoms and principalities. There's now a new Hansa. 10 years ago, those Hansa cities rejoined, saying Russia, Finland, Denmark, Germany, not relevant. Those port cities linked from the channel all the way up to Russia define the interdependence of the sea. So we don't have to recognize or acknowledge that cities have become important. That is simply a fact. We don't have to push people to see that interdependence is the new reality of the world. That is simply a fact. And people who don't see it, like anybody who refuses to look at reality, will fail. Will make a greater mess than they already have. You might not like cities. You might prefer other forms of life. You might not like interdependence. You might like the idea of a national culture. It's comforting solidarities, its habits, make British so precious to tourists and others, as well as to the British. You might not like what's happening to it, but it has happened. It's done. There's no going back. Really? People think that they're going to retrieve that Britain that has been gone for at least 75 or 100 years, that England. The question is, how do we adjust to and live in the interdependent, multicultural, mobile world in which today, just to take one example, there are 60 million people in motion, most of them illegally, some looking for jobs constructively, others fleeing genocide and civil war, but all of them in motion, moving across borders with the logic of terrorism, the logic of war, the logic of jobs, the logic of the economy, but not the logic of the traditional nation state. So the nation state says, sorry, you're not legal, and 12 million Latinos live in American cities. It doesn't matter whether they're legal or not by the law, by the courts, in terms of the logic of the global economy, the logic of interdependence. That's the reality. So here then is the question, is there a way we can organize our government around institutions that acknowledge and recognize that reality and deal with it constructively and make it work for democracy so that it doesn't undermine but reinforces democracy? Because the democratic problem is a powerful one. You talk to young people in the United States, you talk to people of color all over Europe, you talk to refugees and immigrants, you talk to young, single, working mothers, and many of them will say to you, democracy, that's not anything for me, it has nothing to do with me. When Bernie Sanders says, break up the banks, well, he doesn't even know what that means, that's not going to happen. What he means, though, is democracy seems to have more to do with the people who have the money than with us. Unless we find a way to take it back, we're going to lose it. And you see the numbers of middle-class, educated, young people who respond to that message. And I think they're not responding really to the notion that he's going to break up the banks because, as Hillary and others have said, he has got the power to do it, and that's not actually the banks that are doing the most damage. It's the insurance companies, and it's a lot of other organizations that are doing the financial inequality damage. But what they are saying is, we want our democracy back from the elites, from the money, from the banks, from whomever has taken it away from us. And that's a message we need to hear and respond to, or we will indeed lose them. And if we lose the young, and if we lose immigrants, and if we lose people of color, and if we lose all those who have the least power and most need to be empowered in democratic societies, then we truly lose democracy. So this isn't just an issue of governance in an interdependent world where national borders get in the way of the kinds of governance we need. It's also a matter of how we rescue, how we are able to create a society in which people feel not just that I belong, but it belongs to me. It's my government. It's my democracy. It means something to me. That's the challenge we face. And that's where, for me, cities and the role cities can play has been so important. Because it is in cities that you still find, and there are a lot of social science polls around the world in countries everywhere, all five continents, that show when you ask people, do you trust your national government? The average worldwide is about 35% on average, some less, some more, trust their national governments. Ask the same question about, do you trust your municipal leaders, your mayors, your city councilors? On average, about 70% say yes. Double. Because mayors, city councilors, they're your neighbor. They're part of the city. You might agree or disagree with what they're doing, but you feel well what they're trying. A mayor, a city councilor, is a neighbor who takes a stint at running the common society you all live in, and running it in terms that make sense to neighbors. The other thing about cities is that they are far more than what they are often called by Brussels or Whitehall, a level of administration. In unitary top-down organizations, people say, yeah, the city, that's a level of government. Then there's the province, then there's the region, and then there's the national government. That's the real thing. Cities are not a level of government. Cities are the original human community that define sociability, our common humanity. That's why Aristotle said man is a zoon politikon, a political animal, a creature of the polis. We are social. We like to band together. And early on, we went into tribes and then little towns and villages, and in time, larger associations. Ed Glaser at Harvard said, not what Marx said, not that man is a social animal, that man is a group. We like cities, we go to cities. A couple of years ago, the United Nations made a rather remarkable announcement. They said for the first time in human history, half of the global population live in cities. That includes the global south, South America, Africa, not just Europe, North America, where it's more obvious that people live in cities, and where in fact here it's 75% to 80% of the population live in cities. Urbanization is the irresistible and ineluctable destiny of the 21st century and of humanity today. As I say, that's not just because people go to cities for economic reasons, it's because we love cities, we love what they do for us. There's a reason that 95 or 96% of cultural institutions and 92% of universities and colleges and 98% of scientific patents are developed in cities. Culture is not a part of the city, culture is the city. Art doesn't belong to the city as an entertainment medium. Creativity and imagination are central to what brings people to cities. That's why we are here. That's why young people go to the city. So people from all over the world gather around in cities to meet people like them. The social club that was attacked in Orlando, kids subjected brutal murders. Those kids came from all over Florida and all over the United States to be in a town, to be in a city, where they could have a social club. Whether it was a Puerto Rican social club or an LGBT club, but a club where people could come and feel safe. And that's, by the way, why terrorists don't attack farms, they attack cities. They attack what is in cities, because the cities represent everything they despise about modernity. It's cosmopolitanism, it's urbanism, it's commitment to diversity. It's hope, it's imagination. It drives them wild. And they think they can go and set off a bomb in a cafe, or buy an assault rifle, and kill a couple of dozen people. Of course it doesn't work. It's appalling. It's disgraceful, but it doesn't work. Because they're trying to attack not people, but the spirit of the city. You can't destroy the spirit. That's why cities can't be blackmailed by terrorists, pushed around by terrorists. That's what makes them so valuable to all of us. So I'm not talking here about even governance anymore. of the city as an organic institution in which we find our identities. I mean, think about it too, you think about your life. We are born in cities, we grow up, we're educated, we get married, we have children, we have jobs, we pray and we play, we get old, and we die in cities. When you read an obituary, it doesn't say Jake Johnson died in the United States, Muhammad Ali died in the United States. Muhammad Ali's from Louisville. People talk about Louisville when they talk about Muhammad Ali. We identify with the cities where our families are, where our histories are, where our cultures are. So to call them levels of administration just doesn't make any sense. It underrates them, it underappreciates them. And it's also why they are so viable and vibrant as potential governance institutions. Because they are not just about administrative functions, they are about the life functions that enable us to live our lives. Like school, like hospitals, like driving licenses, like jobs, like worship. And it's not just in diverse cities like New York and London and Paris and the West. You go to Istanbul. There's one square in Istanbul where there's a church, there's a synagogue, there's a mosque right around the square. Because again, cities invite diversity of worship. The Swiss might say, no more minarets. They're almost not there to start with. But that's a different voice than the voice that comes from the city. So the city is a terrific place to think about as an institutional response to a multicultural, diverse, interdependent global world, which both manifests and embodies the best of the global world and is in a position to confront and deal with the worst of the global world, global inequality, global terrorism, global disease, global warming. 21 years ago, the United Nations started a new climate change battle. Right? COP meetings. The saddest term I can think of is COP21. Because of the 21. That means for 20 years before COP21 in Paris, this last December, finally did something, not very much, but something on climate. There were 20 meetings of nation states every year, hundreds of states gathering and saying, oh my God, the climate's going to hell. The world's getting hotter, CO2's in the atmosphere, the glaciers are melting, the seas are rising. Oh my God, isn't it terrible? Okay, 2 weeks are up, time to go home. Year after year after year, COP5, COP10, COP15 was Copenhagen, where a lot of people thought, oh, that's going to be special. And finally, COP21, they did finally, after 21 years, agree that maybe they'd try to halt the temperature rise at 2 degrees Celsius. Most scientists announced almost immediately that 2 degrees Celsius would inundate about 2 or 3 miles of shorelines all over the continents and displace about a third to a half of the population. That's the bargain we made for success. If it goes above 2 degrees, if this agreement doesn't work, it's going to be far worse. That's what nation states did facing the most urgent problem that the Earth faced. It's very simple. So it is time for cities now to take their history, their culture, their diversity, their strength, their demography, their democratic majorities, and the reality that they generate 80% of the world's wealth, and put some muscle on their bones and say, nation states aren't doing it, it's time for cities to do it again. Not one by one, as happened before the nation states, but together, in networks, and leagues, and associations, and eventually in a global parliament of mayors, a body that, unlike the disunited nations, the United Nations, allows governments to come together and address and solve problems in common from a perspective that manifests where the world really is. And mayors, because they are in cities where the real problems are natural problem solvers. They actually get things done. They have to. In the last 2 years, the government of the United States of America closed its doors twice, you might remember, once for a week and once for about 2 weeks. Well, first of all, nobody noticed. Not much was happening in Washington for quite a long time. But of course, the other thing is, to the extent they did notice, some terrible things happened. But think of this. Whitehall might close its doors. Brussels might freeze. The government of Brazil has ceased to operate. There's been no government of Marriott in Belgium for 10 years. But things move on. But imagine now we close Liège. We close Amsterdam. We close Bristol. We close Louisville. We close New Orleans. You can't close a city. What? No police, no fire, no hospitals, no schools, no sewer, no garbage collection. That's where the real work of government is done. And mayors know that. Mayors can't afford the luxury of an ideological quarrel. What sort of a state should we have? Should it be a minimal state that lets the market do things? Or should it be a state estate where the state does a lot? Let's argue about that. And while we're arguing, let's not do anything. That's sort of been the history of Western government for the last 50 years. Abstract ideological arguments about a 19th century form of social organization in industrial societies that don't exist anymore, in the post-industrial world of the knowledge economy. But where that's what divides, look at this, left and right. Labor and Tory, Republican and Democrat, Social Democrat and Socialist. All our party labels at the national level are about these abstract arguments. It's not that they're not important, it's not that they don't have some merit, it's that they seem to have very little to do with actually running governments on a day-to-day basis, which is why so many mayors who have been successful don't even claim to be members of parties anymore. Michael Bloomberg started as a Democrat, became a Republican, and finally after a year, the mayoralty said, you know, those terms are irrelevant. I'm the mayor. I'm an independent. He didn't mean independent as an independent party. He meant, I'm an independent. That doesn't matter. Mayor Bloomberg was a wealthy businessman, but he knew he could not crap all over the unions, the public unions in New York, and he didn't. He was succeeded by Bill de Blasio, a fairly left-leaning city councilor who came in with a kind of ideological perspective. A little like Bernie, the first thing he said is, let's throw out the developers. They're not providing affordable housing. Let's close down Wall Street. They're not distributing the wealth. And then a few people on Wall Street in the Gulf said, okay. There's Chicago and LA and Atlanta are anxious for us to go there. We'll just move on. So, that's not what I had in mind. And then within a year, he started to negotiate with them. And to his credit, he said to the housing industry, stay here, work with me, but you're going to have to do more affordable housing than you've done in the past if you want to get licenses from the city. And they're doing that. And that's what mayors have to do. They need private industry, they need business, they need civil society, they need universities, they need foundations, they need public sector unions to operate. Cities stand on a basis of consensus or fall if they don't have it. And again, mayors know it, which is why mayors can't really afford to be ideologues. I'll tell you something. You know what Bernie Sanders did before he ran for Congress? He was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And you know who he worked with as mayor of Burlington, Vermont? The Burlington banks, the Burlington real estate lobby. And he was a damn good mayor. Because he had figured out to make Burlington work, he needed them all. He needed to work together with them. And he figured out how to do it. Now you're running for national government. Sure, free education for everyone. Close down the banks. Break up the banks. Socialism everywhere. Great rhetoric for an election. Useless in actually trying to figure out how to make cities, states, and national governments work. And again, mayors know it. Bernie knew it when he was the mayor of Burlington. He kind of forgot it. For national office. I actually told him he might have a chance to win if he said, I'm going to run the country the way I ran Burlington. But he wanted to run the ideological campaign, and that's what happened. So we require, we need a world in which cities are able to fight at their proper weight. Right now, cities are fighting under their weight. They're not really expressing the power and authority they should have. They don't have the resources to do what they need to do, but you know what? That's very strange because cities generate 80% of the GDP of the world. They get less than a half or even a third of it back from Brussels, from Whitehall, or from Washington, where the money goes. And they have to beg for it. They beg for money that they generate. Their energy and vitality and workers generate. Why? And then they have to beg for the jurisdictional authority to do things. The mayor, the governor of Ohio, was the same case that you ran for president last year, said there are a lot of infrastructural problems in Ohio. We need to fix our sewers. And he sent out, he got the state legislature under to pass a law saying cities must fix their sewers. And the city said, okay. The mayor said, we'll do it. Who's paying for it? The governor said, that's your problem. So here, a large statewide infrastructural problem is handed over as a responsibility to the cities because the state can't do it, but without the resources to do it. That happens again and again. The term is used as unfunded mandate. One of the big questions of devolution, we talked about it this afternoon at Alex's center. One of the big questions is devolution going to be another form of the unfunded mandate? Here, cities, you do it, but don't expect us to help with resources. The resources come from you. Don't expect us to help by ceding sufficient jurisdictional authority that you can actually get the work done without us letting in and say, no, you can't do it that way, you have to do it this way. Cities have the energy and whatever to who they are, the resources to do it, but will they get the financial wherewithal? Will they get the jurisdictional authority to be able to exercise the power they have? And that's another reason for a global parliament mayors, because cities need to do it together. The United States mayors, sick and tired of the absence of progress on climate change, have started to pass drilling and fracking bans. No fracking in my city. No drilling in my city. And the federal courts have said, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. Washington, D.C. finally regulated guns and said, we're banning assault rifles in Washington, D.C. The federal courts said, against the Second Amendment. I have a proposal for cities in the United States and around the world. One city banning fracking, court takes them right out. How about 100 cities banning fracking? How about 1,000? Let's say the courts now sue 1,000 cities. How about every city in America saying no more assault rifles? We won't allow them. Our police force will confiscate them. Yes, federal courts will say, Second Amendment will say, can't do that. Unconstitutional. Fine, sue us. Take us to court. Put me in jail. Cities also can exercise civil disobedience, which is the reality for places that are deprived of what is their right. And mayors and cities and city councilors have a right to sustain the life and liberty and property of their citizens. That's the nature of the social contract. The social contract says, I will give up my natural liberty and get out of the state of nature where it's a war of all against all. In return, I will obey a sovereign if that sovereign protects my life and liberty. Nation states apparently can't do that. They can't guarantee sustainability. They can't guarantee an end to climate change. They can't guarantee that guns will not run rife and create a war of all against cities among young people, the sort of thing that is in Chicago. And cities have a right to say, you can't do it, we will. It is our responsibility, it is our right to sustain the lives and liberties of our citizens. And the only way we can do it is to do it together. 100 British cities working together. 1,000 British and European cities working together. 10, 15,000 cities worldwide saying, we will take this action on climate change together, whether or not our national governments or the UN approve. They will have the Democratic majority on their side because that's what the people are. They will have the rich on their side because that's where the money, the industry, the creativity is. And let's see what happens. Because, by the way, it's the same citizens who vote in municipal elections who vote in national elections. The weird thing is that often people vote nationally with the left part of their brain and locally with the right part of their brain. Nationally, they say, well, I'm a socialist, and I'm going to vote for the Labor Party. But locally, they say, man, this is a damn good man. I like him. She's done pretty well. Technically, she's a Tory, but she's not really. She's just a good man. Well, we should start voting our urban interests nationally. Start thinking about the things we care about locally and locally when we vote nationally. Because it turns out the nation state is the middleman out. Cities don't just think about urban problems. Mayors don't just deal with urban issues. They deal with global issues. Because it turns out urban issues and global issues are identical. Climate change. 75-80% of cities are underwater. Rivers, lakes, seas, oceans. Cities will be the first to feel the effect of sea rise and extreme weather. So that's something they care about. Terrorism, we've seen, is an urban problem. Refugees, an urban problem. And those are all global problems as well. Inequality. Where do the consequences of a global unequal economy play out? They play out in the city. So urban problems are global problems. It's the national governments that seem to be distracted and interested in other things. They don't seem to be interested either in the city or in the global problem. Oddly, nation states have become parochial. We used to say cities are very parochial, kind of local. They don't get the big picture. Nation states don't get the big picture. Cities and mayors and citizens of cities get the big picture. When they work together, they can do something about the big picture. So this is an appeal then. I'm going to stop so we can have some discussions together. I've got 20 minutes. We're going to go to 10 or something, as we said. But I want to leave you with a thought. That we shouldn't just say, yes, cities are important, yes, we need to pay more attention to them. They need not just to be in power, but to take the power democratically, to do the things that cities alone can do, and they need to do them together. In organizations and networks like ICLE and the C40 Climate Cities, UCLG, the Euro Cities, and Energy Cities Europe, there are dozens of these organizations. And also in a global muscular political body that can put some real muscle and give some strong common voice to cities, a global parliament of mayors. And I'm happy to tell you that on September 10th to 12th in The Hague, there will be an inaugural convening of a global parliament of mayors. With probably about 100 mayors from all 5 continents around the world. And that will be a meeting in which cities will have an opportunity not just to share practices, not just discuss common but to speak in a common voice and to enact and begin to develop common policies that they will put their collective voice and numbers behind and say, if necessary, we will defend it in the courts, we will defend it against our national governments. The cities of Britain, the 7 who will finally have elected mayors next year, should not think they are alone and that, well, let's see if we can make devolution work. Devolution is a global problem. And the cities of Britain and the cities of Europe and the cities of Latin America and the cities of Asia and the cities of Africa have in common a need to say more power, more resources, more jurisdiction, and we will act not just nation by nation, but across borders globally. And when we do, we will begin to deal with the global problems that nation states have before it. There is no longer. The default in national sovereignty is a brief for a new city sovereignty. And that's a term some of my friends in international law are using. They're saying, you know, city sovereignty can assure that international law is actually enacted. Nations don't, for the most part, do very much on behalf of international law. Cities do and can. So they have not just resources in democracy, they have law to global law on their side. I say all of this to say to you that despite the kind of bleak times we live in, where MPs are murdered and young people are slaughtered by crazies and bigotry in their heads, that there is still hope for democracy, there is still hope for governance. And the great thing is, it doesn't just start in cities, it starts bottom up. It starts with you, it starts with citizens. Because the empowerment of cities is about the empowerment of citizens. The sovereignty of cities is about the sovereignty of citizens, and that's where sovereignty belongs. So despite the tough times, I believe the city gives us reason for hope, hope for democracy, hope for a solution to climate change, terrorism, and hope, above all, for young people that not just they can survive, but they can have a future worth having. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Benjamin. That was fantastic. And roaming around the international perspective, kind of cities as places where cities as places where people come together and do things and create things and innovate. So places that are, you know, part of the economy of culture, and I think really interesting to think about the role they can play globally as well as locally in taking charge. Enough from us. I hope you won't mind. We started 10 minutes late. I'd like to finish 10 minutes late, but probably 10 minutes late. So I hope that will work with most of you, if that makes sense. So can I go straight to questions? I'm going to get a few questions and then come back to Benjamin. So can you just say who you are and where you're from? And there's a mic coming around to just a couple here.
Thank you. Jack Minty from the Department of Communities and Local Government. My question is, you talk about hope for democracy. How do we ensure we engage people so that next year people go out and vote for these new mayors?
It's all about turnout, yeah, great question. There's one here, and there's one just there.
Two questions. One, Jeff Austin, Julian. Love the idea of London, you know, punching its weight. But two questions. Henry Binsberg, politics and markets. The issue about managing global corporations for a global world, how do you fix that? And two, a linked issue, which is organised crime. How do you manage that?
Lovely. That was a lot of questions in one. Thank you very much. And then one here, and then I'll come back. I'm keeping track.
Hello, my name is Tim Shagwa from C40. And thank you for your talk. I've read your book a long time ago, and I found it really inspiring and thought-provoking. And I know work in the city sphere, and I think it was one of the publications that influenced me quite a bit. Yet there was one problem that I always had with your argument. And I've grown up in the countryside, and I thought that one thing that I felt was left behind, or one group of people that was left behind in your model, is the rural population, and you find some really harsh words against the rural, how you call it, in your book. So I was wondering, how would that parliament of mayors include the rural population that is shrinking, but is still there, and that is included in the nation state?
Great. We'll start with those. So turnout, first of all. I mean, that's a big issue that we're talking about a lot here. How do you get the turnout side?
I'll tell you how you don't get it out. Oh, now you have another election to worry about, not just the national election. You can vote for your mayor, so please vote. That's very important. That's not how. That's why I think the argument needs to be a little more radical. It needs to be about citizens' disempowerment, about the fact that your votes on the whole don't make much of a difference in America, whether you're Republican, Democrat, here, whether you have Labor or Tory or Lidlab or whatever. This is the only vote that counts. You're not voting for mayor, you're voting for your own son. I think how the argument is framed is going to be critical. If it's framed as simply another vote, it's not going to work. So a lot is about the framing, and a lot of people in this room I know work in the urban sphere, work in the city organizations, different parties, and I think it's got to be framed. I use this word not the way Bernie uses revolution, but it needs to be framed radically. By which I mean it has to go to the roots. This is about Britain getting 7 elected mayors finally after all these years, and it needs 70 more. That is a gigantic revolutionary change, and it is a radical vote. It is a vote not just to vote for your mayor, but to say my citizenship and my vote really matter. So I think the framing of it is very important. The second question
was about politics and markets and global politics, yeah, and organized crime.
Let me say two things. One, despite what I say with the nation state, I don't mean for a moment to suggest it's going anywhere. You know, obviously, it's not going away with its banks and its navies and armies and so on. It's here to stay, and a lot of things it needs to do. One of the problems cities have is with the economy is that cities are forced to deal with the consequences of a global economy, namely inequality, without being able to deal directly with global economies. So they're dealing with the consequences without being able to take on those issues directly. And that is a very large problem. That's why cities have to also influence national governments and international organizations to deal with those things. But what's interesting, and there are two chapters in the book in which I talk about it, there are a lot of things that cities can do when they're innovative and imaginative about inequality, even if they can't deal with the core causes. And that's, you know, good. A lot of good doctors can deal with symptoms in ways that actually cure a patient, even if they can't get created the thing. Let me just give you a few examples. One you know well here in London, the squat economy. The squat economy is a way of saying there's an awful lot of real estate around that's owned by rich people and used in all kinds of ways that has nothing to do with the welfare of the city. We are going to, in the city, pass laws that allow people to live in those places and stay in those places and not be sued out of those places by the people who are misusing property that they're not really using. So the squat economy, which sounds a little kind of off color, wasn't. Is actually a great way that cities can rent control is another. Affordable housing is another. So there are lots of ways you can deal with the consequences of inequalities for which you're not responsible. Education, jobs, health care, those all are equalizers.
Yeah.
So that the victims of the global economy, and that doesn't cure the problem, but it's a very real thing that cities can do instead of throwing up their hands and saying, well, it's not our fault.
And I think one of the interesting challenges for here is that some, well, Manchester will have control over healthcare, but many cities won't have that control. So I think that, you know, one of the things that will happen here, I think, is we'll see where this evolves and how much more control, you know, people do more control at that kind of city and city region level. But the other question was about rural population.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you a cynical answer and then a nice one. The cynical answer is for about 5,000 years, the rural peoples of the world have dominated the world and are responsible for a fair amount of the problems we have today. If you just think Vichy, you know, La France profonde during World War II, Vichy France. I mean, to this day, a quarter of the American population in rural counties made up of old white Protestant men and women, mostly through the Tea Party and other organizations, have completely dominated the 75% of people who live in cities, people of color, American people. So maybe if we reverse that for a while, politically that's not such a bad idea. Finally, let cities at least have their democratic and economic weight felt, even if it means some people on the other side now are going to find themselves in a position where they can no longer be a minority of the population, nonetheless dominate the politics of the country. We still have subsidies for agriculture in America that are absurd. People in cities are taxed to pay corn growers and grain growers as well, subsidies for which they have no need and no deserve, and that is about the domination of the world. So that's the kind of cynical answer. It's kind of tough, we're the majority, we have the resources, live with it. That's a very cynical answer. It's partly true though. But here's a better answer. The division between city, suburb, exurb, and countryside is as artificial as the division. In fact, the reality of our lives is an interdependence of the inner city, the suburbs, the exurbs, and the agricultural and watershed areas around the city without which it can't live. And oddly, the medieval city kind of had it right. The medieval city actually was a market for the farmers around to protect them during times of war, but it integrated and dealt with the countryside. We need today to create metro regions that extend the boundaries of medieval cities and early modern cities to encompass the suburbs, the exurbs, and the countryside around Paris. We talked about this afternoon, has a plan that started with Sarkozy, actually, and Delanoë has continued now with the new mayor, Hidalgo, which says Paris can't be the twain rich or only spot, surrounded by a bunch of a bunch of suburbs beyond the periphery that have poor people and immigrants and so on, let that at all. Paris has to be a grand metropole Paris. It has to encompass the regions beyond the three departments immediately around Paris and the four departments beyond that. And there's a plan now to try to integrate them and say Paris is all of those. And that is to include the city and the country. In New York, about a quarter of the shopping done now by people, including my wife, when they shop, is shopping Hudson Valley Park. The Hudson Valley in New York, the agricultural region, the dairy region near New York, provides an extraordinary amount, much more than you think, of the fresh produce for the city that's being included. So the fact is, we are already acknowledging the interdependence of those. And that's a better answer, because that's really, of course, people who live in rural areas should be excluded from new governance and so on, they should be included. But the way to do it, I think, is through the growth of metro regions, spread out and maintain the central authority of cities, but include an equity and reciprocity in the regions.
Thank you. If I can keep my promise of finishing promptly, can I ask that questions are, I'm going to get all of the questions, and then you'll have maybe 30 seconds.
I think what you're asking is that I be brief for any questions.
Everyone's in corporate, and there'll be time off, as I hope. So there's a question just here. I'm going to kind of go around, come back.
I wonder what will happen with international relations when they become inter-cities relations. I think it's an extra benefit because now we have inequality, China and Monaco having one vote in the United Nations. If you imagine hundreds of cities in China and Monaco, then it will be much more equality, not only political, but also social and economic.
Okay. Great question. And then...
The middle there,
two there, and then
one there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get to
who you are.
My name's Barney Evans, I work for the WSP. Just a brief question. You seem to support the government close to the people idea, small is beautiful, but then you seem to suggest that the UK should remain in the EU, which seems to be the opposite of that. Just your thoughts on that.
Great, thank you. And just further up.
I used to work for a directly elected mayor, Sir Peter Salisbury in Leicester. And it was when he was first elected, and the biggest problem that held us back was a lot of the toxic politics. So the city bit mayors work on, but the pressure on one person is immense. How do we protect mayors from the sort of things that drag them down, that's dragged down national politics?
Thank you. And then just about that.
Alex Holloway at Bandon Public Affairs. As cities get more powerful and grow their competences, do you envisage some sort of animosity between nationally elected politicians and locally elected politicians?
Great
question.
And then
I'm looking,
there's
nobody else on okay, so just 1, 2, 3, and then we'll stop there. Yeah, we'll just do it all. Otherwise, I won't be late. Richard Gandhi, you need, and I'd like to know, you're developing a narrative about actually how nation states sit comfortably with the world you paint of cities, which is a very compelling one, but you leave a big gap in how that moves forward. And secondly, in this country there's been a debate going on, which is still a real debate, which is making the issue of elected mayors vulnerable, which is in many localities, cities are saying, ah, but we've got elected leaders who lead our cities through the political message for those people who promote leaders and actually are really only accepting mayors because they get a government pound.
Okay, last two, I promise.
Hello, I'm Tanya Rock, editor of Journal of Urban Design. I hail from Istanbul, one of the great cities of the world. And over the past half a century, I've lived in Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and this great city of London. And I lived in Chicago during the period of first Mayor Daley, and then in Philadelphia during Mayor Rizzo's time. And my old city, Istanbul, had Erdogan. And in London, we have, of course, a very different type of urban mayor and urban government. Three of those four cities, we were really fiefdoms. How can we ensure that we have democracy in an elected mayoral system rather than fiefdoms?
Okay, thank you. And a final question now.
Hi, my name's Oscar. I work at the Cushion. Whenever we talk to people about regional devolution, they're very happy to have local decision making. But everyone hates postcode lotteries. Everyone hates the postcode lottery and kind of not having something because their local decision maker has moved against their direction. How do we explain to normal people who are not like us and don't do this for fun people that this stuff does mean maybe losing out?
Okay. Okay, there's a set of great questions which I'm going to go back through. So starting off with intercity relations and international. So will this make it easier if you've got all the cities in China, you've got one way teachers instead of just China and Monaco?
Yes, yes, no, yes, yes, no.
Okay, we're
yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think there is a, it's not that cities, there are rich and poor cities, there are developed cities, obviously Paris and Mexico City, those with large amount of equipment. Obviously the new cities in China that are going out at a rate of a city of a million every month or so, a new city with new people, are not the same as traditional cities. But there is that sense, for reasons we've talked about, and I've talked about, that there is a more egalitarian. Let me quick answer another question related to that, which is, what's to stop cities once they are more governing from being competitive? Some like there said, our cities are going to be competitive and become rivals of one another once they have more power because they'll become more like states. And the answer to that question is because they're not border, because they're not nation states, because they don't rub up against one another, cities can grow and flourish mutually and reciprocally. When Germany gets bigger, as its neighbors learn, Belgium and Poland get smaller. But Brussels, Berlin, and Warsaw can all flourish. You know, they can all have been, indeed, when they do flourish, as the Hans of Warsaw has done, they tend to flourish together. So cities are not involved in a zero-sum game.
Okay.
Because they are territorial, they are, so I think that's a fundamental difference.
Small is beautiful, but versus being members of the EU.
Well, you know, apples and oranges, because what I said, small is beautiful, and therefore let's go back to cities, but I also said the EU system in which cities are talking to one another. And for me, a Europe of cities would be a much better bet than a Europe of states, and going back to your point, a Europe of cities would be much more agreeable to its citizens. The problem with Europe isn't so much that it's too big, but that it's too undemocratic. It's concerned with bureaucracy, it's concerned with regulation, it's concerned with economic benefits, it's not very concerned with citizens. Summed up, Europe has been about the euro, not the European. That's why a lot of Europeans have gotten angry about the wealth. There's no such thing as European. I'll go back to being Dutch or English or Italian. Show me a real European or I'm filling my citizenship and identity as a people like that. So I don't think they are. In fact, I think they're both part of the same thing. They're part of identifying locally in ways that enable you to cross borders and talk to people.
And there was a collection of questions about being a mayor, so that kind of huge pressure on the mayor, toxic politics that can get in the way, how you ensure actually it's a democracy, not a fiefdom, and something about how do you get across to cities that a mayor is different to an elected leader when they might not want to vote.
Let's start with the reality that mayors and public officials are human beings and they're frail and they're subject to corruption and there will be plenty of corrupt mayors and there'll be plenty of people who, you know, are problematic, and the old joke in New Jersey is that there are more mayors in jail than in office there. So, you know, it is a problem, and corruption in cities is a problem. Although I look, my teacher Carl Friedrich from Germany once said, corruption in cities is like arsenic. A little bit is necessary to life, too much destroys life. Corruption is a way, and we learned that in the 19th and 20th century. In early Tammany Hall and, you know, city, urban corruption was a way of easing things. Too much bureaucracy, nothing gets done. A little bit of greasing the wheel, a little bit of knowing the right person helps the city move. Too much of it is dangerous. So we want to know that, you know, there is a certain role for some degree, call it corruption, call it not following the rules too precisely, and so on, that works. The democratic character of elections, it's true, it's very different in different places, and larger cities often have a larger problem with it, which is also why larger cities tend to have city councils and others, and while there can be some conflict, New York has, I'll say something very simple, a city like a state that is unitary and central has a much more difficult time being democratic than a city that is federal and divided. New York City has 5 boroughs, 41 districts and about 194 neighborhoods. And that's one of the reasons it really works well, because I'm a member of my block association, I'm part of the Upper West Side, from Manhattan, District 41 is my district, and I have district councilmen. You have a system like that, you don't count on just one politician, and maybe there's corruption here, but not there. So having the problem with the new Chinese cities going up is that they have no neighborhoods. When you're high rise, by cities, there's no neighborhood, there's no sense of belonging to a local entity within these new cities of a million people. So I think government that way. The second thing is, if cities begin to imitate what states do and treat citizens as spectators who participate once a year by voting,
yeah,
then they will be problematic. The most democratic cities are not democratic because of turnout for the mayor, even the mayor is particularly uncorrupt, but cities where citizens participate, participatory budgeting, block associations, PTAs, that they are engaged. Citizens can engage when they do in the municipal level in a way you cannot engage in the national level. Imagine saying, I'm a good citizen, how do I engage with Whitehall? That's not happening. But if you say, how do I engage with Lambeth? Well, maybe you can begin to figure out ways that that can happen. So I think that's an area in which that kind of democracy works. And finally, you know, this comes to Trump and other people. We see Democratic voters do a lot of pretty crazy things. No Democratic theorist has ever defined democracy as government for and of the people, defined by individual, desirous, selfish individual. Democracy is about citizens. Citizens is about deliberation, about education, about being a member of the community. And the reason that Donald Trump, or maybe even Brexit, can get a lot of votes is because people aren't citizens. They're voting their prejudices, their bigotries, their fears, and their anxieties. They're not voting their sense of the common good.
Okay.
And citizens are about the common good. When you have a system of citizenship based on deliberative exchange among citizens about the common good, I would trust that citizenry.
Okay. I'm very conscious that I'm still running over. So the last 30-second response, if I may, to that question of how do you kind of get this as part of the national debate? How do you make this acceptable, these mayors, to the national states and avoid this being about personal interests?
No, and that's it. That's a very good question. I'll answer it in one simple way. The citizens of the nation state are the same as the citizens of cities. And if the citizens of cities buy the solution and vote for their mayors, they are the same ones who will put national government in office. Other part is, national government will be greatly helped if cities are functional and can take on a lot of the burdens. And you know, doctors in America learned a long time ago that when mothers participate in the birth, instead of having the Hollywood birth, which is all done under drugs, the birth is much safer and much better. National governments learned that when cities participate in the execution of policy and the making of policy, the state works better too. So it will be in their interest to do so, and citizens will help enforce and realize that information.
Fantastic. I mean, it's been wide-ranging, and I'm sorry, I hope we can continue the conversation over drinks, but I think this idea of cities, the places people live, work, create, interdependent, globally interdependent, but also local. And it needs to change the conversation, the way we think about this, the way we think about the decisions we're taking at different levels, I think is really powerful. We're going to keep the conversation going about mayors. We'd certainly like to keep talking to you. Thank you all very much for coming. Do stay for drinks, and can I ask you to thank Dr. Barber?